Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, November the 13th, 2025, and this is episode 3,700 and, well, I don't know. That would be 3,759 of the Survival Podcast. It is a Thursday, I do know that, so I also know something else. It is time for an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. I got a great lineup for you of expert counsel members today, leading off, as is typical, Chris Rossini and Dr. Ron Paul. They're going to talk about the Orange Man's golden age fantasy versus the mass layoff reality. I have to say that I have gone for about, you know, pretty much all year saying, no, I'm not disappointed in the Orange Man, because I didn't expect much. I expected an end to some of the leftist nonsense, but I didn't expect like stellar performance. Even I now am becoming disappointed. How a person with such business acumen can do so many stupid things so rapidly, I just don't know. How someone with so much political clout can commit so much political suicide so rapidly, I just don't know. How the fuck we're sending the absolute most powerful warship ever created, a carrier that literally can level a country without unleashing a nuclear weapon, to the freaking coast of Venezuela, I don't know. I just don't know. I just don't get it. Additionally, some of the economic decisions that have been made, I actually have a different view, but not all of it is as bad as it tends to be seen by the libertarian circles. With the context of, but this is where we are, so these are the things you have to do based on the circumstance. But still, I would think the mass layoff reality may be coming soon, just in time for the fucking midterms next year, so the lunatic left can take over, because the lunatic left is dribbling down. So we'll see what Chris and Ron have to say when we get there, but I have a feeling I'm going to agree with, say, 90-ish percent of what they have to say this week. Doc Bones will talk about the point where cannabis use becomes cannabis abuse, and I think that the person in this story that he's addressing has a much bigger problem than cannabis. And cannabis in this situation would be what we would call an aggravating agent, not the cause of, but something making the problem worse. This sounds like lack of freaking motivation and failure to launch to me, more than a drug problem. This problem is being exacerbated by the crutch of a drug. And the guy makes just enough money to be able to buy enough of the drug to really enjoy himself, because cannabis isn't that expensive. Joel Riles, we'll talk about introducing prong collars to, say, a new dog or a dog's never had one, maybe an adopted dog. When to use them, how to use them, how often should the dog wear the collar. I'll have one little caution I'll add to Joel's advice with this, because I've seen it happen. Andy McCann will talk about alternative options for your health versus mainstream medicine and drugs, things like essential oils, herbs, and other things, technologies. Mike Melito will talk about choosing a bolt action for big game season, which is upon us. Many of you guys are already out in the woods. If not, you soon will be. And the number one weapon that people seek and use when it comes to shooting a deer or an elk or a bear, not 100%, but the number one is the bolt action rifle, for many reasons. I don't know what he said yet, because I'll listen to his segment as I put the show together and respond to it accordingly if necessary. But I have always said of the bolt action, the reason it's the most common is commonality, there are so dang many of them, reliability, okay, and legality. So in my state, for instance, if you want to go get an AR, like an AR-10, it's in 308 or some other, you know, Wildcat round or anything like that, rack a 20-round mag and it's sitting a deer blind and lay waste to a deer with it, or even like for something that's unregulated like wild hogs, like wipe out a whole herd, that's totally kosher. In Pennsylvania, they'll put you under the jail for that. Right? Not really. You get a big fine and I'll take your gun away. Yeah, so the thing is that those bolt, like if you can hunt big game with a centerfire rifle, then you can use a bolt action. So that's where the legality comes in. We'll see what Mike has to say. Kerry Brown will talk about foraging tree nuts in the fall with uses beyond just edibility. And I have a little add-on to that. If he doesn't cover it, I don't know. I know I started to listen to these just to make sure I have the angle right when I put the notes out and when I do the intro. And I know his first tree talks about is black walnut. I have a particular use for black walnut. He kind of went into the medicinal space. It's not medicinal, but it's something we did every year that involved black walnut. And if he doesn't tell you that you can do this with it, I will. And then I'm going to do something a little different for this time of year. I'm going to say, be radical. And you're like, Jack, pretty much your whole fucking vibe is radical. Like, you're always radical. Everything you teach is radical. Even if it's logical, opposed to society's, you know, angle, it would be considered radical. No, this is a different kind of radical. I'm going to suggest something. We are heading into kind of the coast down part of the year, and I do it. This is where, you know, I take off my Thursday and Friday for Thanksgiving. I kind of do some fun shows in between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And then I vanish like a fart in the wind the week of Christmas, sometime before Christmas Day. Usually the 23rd or 22nd will be my last show of the year. We play the Christmas special show on whichever day is the day after I disappear, like Santa Claus. Because maybe I am Santa Claus. Maybe that's why I have a big beard this year. Maybe I have to go deliver toys and then I need a break after that to get ready and get out. Then, you know, I come back all charged up, and I'm going to keep doing that. But then what happens after Christmas, New Year's Day? And what does everybody do for New Year's? The New Year's resolution. Here's my radical thought. Start your New Year's resolution before Thanksgiving. Oh, Jack, I'm going to eat all the bad food and I'm going to not eat. It's okay. I'm going to tell you how to do it. You can eat all the bad food for Thanksgiving and even for that day after party, right? Or you can eat it on Christmas or the Christmas party. Like, you don't have to be a Nazi to yourself here. And the most important part of a New Year's resolution is the mental resolution, the psychological resolution. And I'm going to tell you that's precisely why doing it when everybody else is doing it, that when everybody else is doing it, that's like precisely when you shouldn't. You get caught up in this wave and like this waiting and this putting off, and it's just another form of the toolbox fallacy. When you do a New Year's resolution, what you're saying is, there's something in my life I want to change. But instead of changing it now, I'll wait for the new year. And this is why there is such a high flipping failure rate among New Year's resolutions. I'm going to get in shape. I'm going to join a gym. And the gym salespeople love January and the end of December. That's when they sell all the memberships. And the wife said she wanted a membership, the husband says he. So the spouse goes out and buys the membership for them. And you go to the freaking gym like the first Monday after work. You know, when you get back to work, so it might be the 4th, the 3rd, whatever, of January. And it's the first like 4 to 7 p.m. timeline. And the gym is jammed. Fat dudes on every piece of equipment sweating their ass off. Walk in there on like January 25th and it's back to the way it looked in November. Yeah. So I'm not even saying to go start working out. I'm saying that there's actually like that is the big one and the one that fails the most. I'm going to start working out. I'm going to go on a diet, right? There's so many things we need to do to improve ourselves in life from a mental standpoint. And that can begin now. And even if diet and exercise are part of it, then do that now. And then when Thanksgiving comes, eat until you can't move, like you always do, and then go back to it. We'll talk about that more in just a bit. And why, if you do it now, your odds of still being on whatever program you put yourself on April 1 are much higher if you start now than you start January, even though you have to do it for about 45 more days. It's crazy, but it's true. And I'll tell you why when we get to my segment. Before we do that, let me remind you, you can always support your show by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. And if you do your shopping there, no matter what you buy, you will help us out. This week, I am really, and next week too, I will really be focusing on the kitchen gear. And there's no secret why. What comes the week after next? I'll tell you, in case you didn't know or your calendar's broken. Oh, the big one, Thanksgiving. Right, Turkey Day comes the week after next. And I'll give you an announcement today, too. On Wednesday next week, I am going to finally redo the Thanksgiving cooking suggestion show. I did one with Chef Keith Snow all the way back in 2010. I've rerun that every year. It was pretty good. But, man, so much has changed. Guys, that's 15 years. 15 years since we did that show. So I reached out to our resident chef today, Chef Ken Daniels, and I didn't know if he'd be available because he's currently, like, working his ass off, developing a new skill set with wild game. He's working for a place that processes deer and exotic game. You know, he'll do that for a couple months, and that'll widen his repertoire. It's just what he does when he has to learn a new thing. He goes and does the job. And that actually teaches you really quick. More on that will be coming with Loss of Life too, by the way, using jobs as the ultimate cheat code. Maybe we'll do a show on that next week. I don't know. Anyway, I didn't know if he'd be available. I said, hey, how about next Wednesday? We get together and do a Thanksgiving show on a live stream. He said, yeah, I'm in. So on Wednesday, we'll be talking about making your Thanksgiving great. And so we'll be doing it the Wednesday before. You'll have all the time in the world to put new things in place going into Thanksgiving next week. So again, back to T-Spaz and my item of the day. I am really focusing for the next few days into next week on things that make your kitchen better. Because this time, and this is like the cooking Super Bowl and the playoffs, man, because you got Thanksgiving, you got after Thanksgiving to do with leftovers, you got holiday parties for Christmas with family and friends and shit, and then you got Christmas dinner and all that. So that's what we're going to focus. Today's item of the day is one I brought you a couple times this year already, though. The Thermo Maven Instant Read Thermometer. You need this anyway. When you're putting steaks on the grill, whatever, you need an instant read. An instant read, as you poke it, it tells you within a couple seconds what the temperature is. This is the only way I could cook steaks for like five family members and get everybody happy. It's the only way. But it's also great for those larger cuts of meat because you get an instant temp on like a breast of a turkey or whatever. There's other options for that. We'll be bringing you one next week on Monday from Vivor, and it's like a probe thermometer that goes to your phone and all. But these are the easy button, and you need them for a lot of other things too. Like, I don't know, is that casserole that you stuck in the oven actually the temperature? Right? Is the stuffing that you put in a casserole dish, because putting in the turkey is kind of dumb, we'll explain why next week, is that the temperature? Right? Are the potatoes the temperature? Like, just being able to instantly get the temperature of anything, $18. And the Thermo Maven is the best. I have thrown instant read thermometers over my fence at my neighbor Dennis. I've been so frustrated with them. I am sick of instant read thermometers that become inaccurate really quick. I'm sick of the ones that use the freaking batteries like we use in a scope or an optical sight, the little like hearing aid style batteries. Do you know why? Not because they're expensive, not because they're hard to get, because all the ones that do it, it's freaking impossible to get them to close. They're just a pain in the ass. For some reason, all the makers of these things that use those batteries, they're a pain in the ass. You know what this one uses? Triple A's. What a freaking idea. Use a standard battery, right? The damn things are big enough. You don't need those stupid little batteries. It's not a light. You don't need a CR123 or some shit like that, right? Just use a basic freaking battery. It also has an auto shutoff. You know what that's good for? Because you will forget to close it. The way they work, when you open them, they kind of open like a pocket knife. And they have a probe. You stick it in, it gives you a temperature. Yeah? Well, inevitably, you're going to set it down with it open. The last one I had, the one I threw over the fence, when you left it open and forgot it, it didn't have an auto shutoff. So it killed the battery. Then you had to open it up. Then you had to fight the battery to get it in. This one, if you leave it there for like a minute, it shuts itself off even though it's still open. Genius. It just works. Got a magnet on it. Sticks to the refrigerator, side of the grill, etc. Got a bottle opener. Hey, you're going to have a brewski when you're making that turkey. It's fantastic. $18 freaking bucks. When these things came out, they were $30. That's what I paid for mine. They've recently reduced the price, somehow with tariffs, to $20. Then they put it on sale down to $18. This is a great product. You need to check this out. It is an excellent, excellent piece of kitchen equipment. And remember, the one I brought you guys yesterday that I didn't say very much about because the show went long, the 22-quart roaster ovens. These are they stand alone, they plug in the wall. You can put a whole turkey in one. You can line them with a bag. These are fantastic because they give you your oven back when you're cooking all that other stuff. So we'll keep building on this toolkit going through next week so that by, you know, Monday of next week, the week following week, you get into Thanksgiving week, anything you're lacking will tell you the tools to use. With that, now, let's go ahead and hear from Dr. Ron Paul and Chris Rossini on the Golden Age Fantasy versus the potential for mass layoff reality.
There's some in the leadership of this country are saying this is the golden age of economics. It's just wonderful. Well, I think overdoing it, overpromising is always dangerous. I tended to always want to underpromise so that if it's a little bit better, then I get a little extra credit. But to overpromise, not a good idea. And I think that's what's being promised to the people, that we're going to be in the age of golden economy. Chris?
That's right, Dr. Paul, and you nailed it. Overpromise. I mean, the Trump administration, if anything, is one giant overpromise. And yes, this This caught our eye. Just in October last month, 153,000 layoffs, the most in 22 years in a month. Right before we went on, I wanted to look up how many manufacturing jobs have been lost just since President Trump took office in January. 39,000, so almost 40,000 manufacturing jobs. Yet there's a great disconnect between what the administration says and the reality. You know, another thing is the tariff war. No one came begging. You remember the whole hoopla of all these countries, they're going to be on their knees begging. No, it was just President Trump issuing insane threats that sent the markets into a tailspin, and then he has to retract the threats because we have no leverage. We're the deadbeat of the world. He has no leverage on anyone else, so he has to retract it. You know, but the administration is dangling, $20 trillion is going to be invested in America. You know, when President Trump was running against the Democrats, it was a novelty. Oh, he says these things and he keeps his enemies on their toes. They don't know which way he's going. That has worn off. You know, it's gotten to the point where nobody even believes anything he says at any time. And that's a shame because there are some things you can't fake. You can't say we're in a golden age, and everybody in America knows this is no golden age.
And although it was worse after the dot-com bubble crashed, the bubble that we have today, I think the bubble, there's no way to estimate exactly, but I think it's many, many fold bigger than the bubble that was available back then.
Yeah, we are, as you mentioned earlier, in the biggest bubble of them all. I mean, we've been through the stock market bubble, the housing bubble, the NASDAQ bubble. This one's the biggest. And I would call it the AI bubble if I had to brand it. And you could tell by our government, that's all they wanted. They're investing. We're going to be the AI this, AI that, AI. And they're pumping just, you know, crazy amounts of money. It's the same story. It's a bubble. I saw this week the U.S. has 5,381 data centers, the most in the world. The next highest is Germany with 521. What do we need all of these data centers? What are they building, the Star Wars Death Star with this? I mean, what are we going to do with all the data centers when this bubble bursts? How do you repurpose these things to make them useful when they're half finished, when they're, you know, useless? They don't think about that. They just build, and this is supposedly prosperity. And, you know, government uses their thoughts about how they want to use AI is much different than me looking up how many jobs were lost in manufacturing. You know, I use AI, and that's not what they want. This is a control mechanism for them in their dreams. This is what they want, a way to control just about everything with AI. That's how they are with all the tools. You know, we use planes to travel from place to place. They use planes to drop bombs. We could use nuclear energy for energy. They bomb Hiroshima. They use every tool for evil. So they're going to use AI for evil. And they have 5,000 data centers already. And they're just keep pumping more and more money. So same story. It's the AI bubble this time. It's not going to end well. And they're just wasting resources, which is a shame.
I don't really have any disagreement here. I actually have a further observation. At all times, each party must have an enemy to point to as the real villain as to why all the problems that neither party ever solves is responsible for what they don't fix, that they always promise to fix, right up until they get into office, and then they blame, of course, the other party. Whether power in the party in power or not, doesn't matter. Both parties, it's like the Spider-Man meme where they're pointing at each other, right? It's like five Spider-Mans all pointing at each other. But they also have to have an external enemy. So that the internal enemy is always the other side, and then the external enemy is always something that's being talked about a lot. And the enemy the Democrats have chosen is not AI itself, because of course they like AI because it can be used for surveillance and eliminating jobs, which Democrats are all for. So are Republicans, don't take it wrong. But they're all for enriching the people that pay them, which are the lobbyists, which are the corporations. So they can't directly target AI. Pay attention. Big tech data centers, the new enemy of the left. Outside of the Nazis of the Republic, the big data centers, they need to pay their fair share. Now, all these fucking big tech companies fund these fucking politicians, okay? They fund the leftist initiatives, other than maybe X now with Elon, who's still not what you think he is. I'm sorry. But, like, all these other giant, like, you know, Meta, right? These are the, like, these are the people that colluded to prop up the mashed potato we call a president, Joe Biden, and get him in office, to banish Trump from all social media, to destroy a company called Parler, all in a sense of, like, they're totally honest, but they're being attacked for data centers. And the data centers are using electricity, and they need to pay their fair share, and blah, blah, blah. Now, nothing will actually be done to stop this, because there's no desire to stop this. It's the newest boogeyman. Have you noticed with all the fucking screaming and yelling and gnashing of teeth about climate change, climate change, climate change? It seems like the 10 years to act now being run for four freaking decades. So we've had 10 years for 40 years. Because let's be honest, this all started the big 10-year first announcement. Look it up if you doubt me. 1989, the IPCC, okay, put out a press release through the AP, the Associated Press. 1989, all the doomsday shit, nations underwater, the Maldives being sink, sea level rises, mass exodus, the whole world will end if we don't act. They first put that out in 1989. Then 1999 came and they rebooted it. We had 10 years to act again. And then 2009 and so on and so forth. So now, then they said 12 years when they introduced Greta to the world. But have you noticed? I mean, it's still, like, they put so much of it out there, it still trickles to the top, but the hysteria seems to have just gone away. Do you notice that? You can only run a boogeyman for so long, and then people go, well, where's the boogeyman? So what came out today was a new study from China and the United States that said, actually, we could be in danger of, wait for it, if you're a 70s or 80s kid, you'll remember it, a new ice age. So while we're having that, we need something else to point to. So despite the fact that some of these tech companies are literally building their own power plants, their own energy production, powering their own facilities, and then selling surplus energy to the grid, it's their fault your electrical prices are high. Yeah, yeah. So that is an interim boogeyman. Watch it. By early spring, if not even before Christmas, you're going to keep hearing about it. But by growing into next year, the tech companies are using too much power. And they'll bring back the climate change in a way. They're boiling the oceans, and they need to pay their fair share. They're never going to pay their fair share. How long have you heard, oh, so needs to pay their fair share? Never pay their fair share. By the way, the only one that's actually made rich people pay their fair share, and don't give me anything about pass-through taxation, because all taxation on corporations is passed through to the consumer. If it's an income tax, it's passed through the consumer. If it's some kind of corporate entity tax, it's passed through the consumer. Every expense that goes on a company is passed through the consumer. Tariffs are no different. So the only president in my modern life that's actually under the banner what the left calls taxing the rich that's done it is Trump. I'm not saying it's good. I'm saying I'm opposed to it, but he's done it. That's what a tariff is. A tariff is a tax on the corporations bringing the product into the country. That would be the number one importer into the country at a mass level, Walmart. But they passed the tax. We already did this. We already covered that. And if you just raise the corporate tax rate on Walmart, do you think they're not going to do the same thing? Are you that daft? Right? And what does Trump want to do right now? Lower income, middle income people, let's take the tariff money and pay it out as a dividend. Bad idea again. Is that not redistribution of wealth by taxing the wealthy and redistributing to the poor? It's exactly what Democrats said they wanted the whole time. Isn't it funny? Now they hate it because Trump's doing it. If Trump was a Democrat, the left would love him and the right would hate him. He is a centrist Democrat, always has been. It's a weird dynamic to watch. Here's the real problem, though, and this ties into what Ron and Chris said. And it's just something people don't want to accept. It doesn't matter what they do anymore. We're in a terminal end stage of our current economic paradigm. Just like I've told you since the very beginning that we were coming up on this, that we're going to have to deal with this in the next couple decades. Here we are, $37 trillion in debt, $40 trillion is not even a fucking question at this point. Right? We are now at a point where we're talking $1 trillion a year in interest on the debt. $1 trillion. The goddamn budget. I'm sorry. I know I'm not supposed to use that. I try not to use that and offend religious people. So please forgive me because I really do try not to say that, even though I drop the F-bomb all the time. But, you know, when we look at it, this is the entire budget of, like, the Department of Defense in interest. It's more money than the cost of Social Security in interest. This is the end stage of an economic empire. They kicked the can and they kicked the can and they kicked the can. You know what my segment was going to be today? The death of the penny is the nickel next. We'll do that in a variety show next week. Okay, because I have this other thing I want to talk about today. But yeah, that's where we are. Let's go on. There's not a lot we can do about that. We're not going to change anything. Let's talk about where does cannabis use become cannabis abuse? Is it an addiction? Can we use that word in more than one way? And what do we do for somebody whose life is a shambles and cannabis is part of that?
Hi, Joel Nindy here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award winner in medicine, The Survival Medicine Handbook, plus designer of a line of medical kits made specifically for the off-grid medic at store.doomandbloom.net. Today's question for the expert council comes from Ariel, who writes, where could I send my younger brother for mental recovery and support? He's hitting rock bottom as I'm not going to enable his bare minimum efforts. He's 35 years old with a wife and three small children under 5 years old. He makes $19 an hour at a bike shop for the last 10 years. He has a heart of gold, but he's a pothead and gamer in major denial and delusion about his life choices. His wife isn't working, isn't cleaning, barely cooks, and self-medicates with TV. Thank you, Ariel. Ariel, this is a very difficult situation, and you're to be commended for wanting to help and smart for not enabling him. Your brother has made questionable life choices that have made his future prospects quite questionable. If he's willing, though, there are resources and options available to him. Now, you mentioned one word that sums up the obstacles your brother has for a more successful and fulfilling life, and that is pothead. Given your description, your brother's wife may have a similar issue, or be negatively influenced by your brother's lifestyle, or vice versa. My concern is addiction. It could be preventing them from becoming more productive, and that's amplified by the fact that children are involved. Now, some people say you can't get addicted to marijuana, more on that in a minute. And it's true that its use is not potentially fatal, like, let's say, fentanyl, heroin, or meth. That's why it's becoming legal as a recreational drug just about everywhere. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't risks to the use of the drug, especially in recent years where the concentration of the psychoactive ingredient, THC, in popular strains has become extraordinarily high. In other words, this isn't your grandfather's weed. Many people mistakenly believe that addiction results from a lack of willpower or moral principles. In reality, addiction is a complex disease that alters the brain, making it hard to quit even for those who want to stop. With cannabis, people can become addicted, especially if potent varieties are used frequently. Continued and heavy cannabis use can cause physical dependency. It's true. Here I should tell our listeners why drugs become addictive and who gets addicted. Drugs target the brain's reward system, flooding it with dopamine and causing feelings of pleasure. Normally, this system motivates healthy behaviors like eating or spending time with loved ones. But drugs hijack this system, reinforcing unhealthy behaviors and disrupting judgment, decision-making, stress management, and even memory. The risk of addiction varies based on three key factors. Biology is one. Genetics account for about half of a person's risk. Other factors like gender, ethnicity, and mental health also play a role. Environment. Family, friends, economic conditions, and life experiences such as peer pressure or early exposure to drugs can influence addiction risk. This is probably in play with your brother. Development. Drug use during key stages of life, especially adolescence, increases the risk. Teen brains are still developing in areas that control decision-making and self-control. making them more likely to engage in risky behaviors like drug use. However, research has uncovered effective treatments that can help people recover and lead fulfilling lives. Of course, there are expensive rehab centers, but the government has a department that actually might help, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration. They have a program called RecoverMe that you can access at SAMHSA, that's SAMHSA.com, to find out more. Call SAMHSA's 24/7 National Helpline at 1-800-662-HELP or 4357. This way you can find free and confidential information in English or Spanish for individuals and family members that are facing substance abuse and mental health issues. Unfortunately, quitting pot isn't always easy for most people. Individuals who smoke weed regularly may find quitting may result in several uncomfortable but not physically dangerous experiences, including cravings and turbulent moods. It can be uncomfortable, but avoiding certain areas that might trigger relapse can prove invaluable. In your brother's case, it might be his game room. Changing the environment where he games might help. Some other suggestions: make a plan. Have a clear goal in mind, in this case abstinence, that might help him stay on track. Get rid of marijuana-related paraphernalia. Identify triggers and strategize how to deal with them. Personal triggers for wanting to use marijuana may differ from someone else's. Figure out pressure points and strategize ways to cope with them in a healthy, substance-free way. Build a strong support network. When it comes to getting sober, or at least reducing drug use, it's important to be surrounded with healthy and supportive people. Building a strong support network, maybe a church or some other place, may help people quit. You want to see if you can find a weed replacement. Take a holistic approach to manage cravings, participating in physical activities such as yoga or exercise, or finding new hobbies can help. But nothing helps someone who doesn't want help. Hopefully, your efforts on your brother's behalf is going to wake him up, and maybe his wife as well. After all, they owe it to their kids. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, don't forget to check out our entire line of quality medical kits and individual supplies at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
So here's my take on this question. Do I think that cannabis is something that people become physically addicted to? In the way that a person would become addicted to something like morphine or another opiate, where when you take that, or heroin, right? When you take that person off that drug, the detoxification that they go through, the withdrawal symptoms that they go through are physical and they are severe, or even cigarettes, nicotine, right? Like when you go through nicotine, it's a pretty serious thing. Now, you don't need to maybe be in a treatment center when you come off of nicotine. You might need some counseling or some help to stick with it, but you can do it. Where there are certain drugs that are physically addictive, the body becomes literally dependent upon them. Alcoholics can go through this too, right? DTs, right? Detox. When they come off alcohol, they stop suddenly, right? And some of these drugs, like heroin, for instance, like it can be literally life threatening symptoms, and they might need medical support to get through it. And the answer to that question is absolutely not. I have never known a person who is a cannabis user who stopped for a few days for whatever reason to like be shaking and freaked out, like somebody comes off fucking coke or crack or something, like tweaking out, or meth. So no, that doesn't mean it's not addictive. Let's put it a different way. Is porn addiction a thing? Does the body in any way become physically addicted to porn? No, the person becomes mentally and emotionally addicted. So the person that leans on cannabis as a crutch for a time can become an addict without being a physical addiction. So I think that both sides in that debate are correct. I also think it can be totally responsibly used, and I do not want the government involved at all. And I think a big part of why we have this super high potency shit today is because of how long it was illegal. The same reason we ended up with really high proof liquor during Prohibition. You could move more with less risk. And with cannabis, there was a lot of places, like if you're under a half an ounce or under a quarter of an ounce or under a certain number of grams, then it was a misdemeanor, and if it was over, you were a felony, so higher potency. So a lot of this work to develop these strains of really potent cannabis were done at a time of full cannabis prohibition throughout most of the country. And that resulted in these super high strains. And then when they legalized, that kind of let the lid off of it. Instead of just being the weed that we all smoked in the 80s, right, when we were in high school or college, which was, again, much lower potency. It doesn't mean it can't be used. You just need less of it, right? However, this individual sounds like they have multiple stages of problems. Their life is not together. They're capable of holding down a job, but they have no ambition. They're basically living in a basement. Like, this person has multiple problems. And what I would never tell a person whose life is screwed up is if you use cannabis, your life will get better. It's not a motivator. It's a depressant. And I know the whole sativa indica thing, and some of it actually, like, and that's the person who has their shit together. If anything becomes a crutch in your life, while you need to be stretching, it can become an addiction. Any behavior can become an addiction. And when you add the psychoactive properties and the physical feel-good nature of something like cannabis to it, or beer, or anything else, it can become more a problem. And I guess the medical term might be more of a habitual than physical addiction, but I think the net result is the same. People become addicted to many things. Some people become addicted to the feeling you get from fear of risk. People that, you know, drive motorcycles really fast or do other daredevil type things become addicted to that rush. And sometimes it's positive. People become addicted to the rush of working out and the endorphin hit. And it becomes a literal physical addiction. That's why you look at somebody and you're like, how does this person never miss a workout? How does this person work out 7 days a week and has done for 10 years? They, on some level, they become physically addicted to that. And as long as you don't overdo it, injure yourself, cause problems for yourself, that's a healthy addiction, right? Some people can become addicted to doing something like building businesses. And as long as you don't let it destroy your other life, and it all has the same, carries the same risk. It doesn't mean it's all the same. It all carries the same risk as a separate statement. And so I would tell you, if you're trying to get your shit together, because your life's in the toilet, and you are a user of any substance, at least until your life's together, to get that substance out of your life. And that's what I think here. You have a multi-stage problem in this individual. Failure to launch, lack of motivation, probably psychologically not in the best place, then throw high-potency cannabis on that. And as long as I can go to work, man, make my money, man, come home, man, not worry about it, man, and smoke my dope, man, then I'm good and play video games. Like, when you're in your 30s playing video games on a daily basis, I'm sorry, unless you're a professional gamer making millions of dollars, you have a fucking problem. And yes, that includes you in my audience who's pissed at me right now. It is not a productive thing. Now, if you're a disciplined person, like, bro, I just blow off steam with it. I come home. I do my other shit that I need to take care of. And I play for 30 minutes. When the alarm goes off, I'm done. Never met one of you guys. If I meet you, I'm good with you. But if you're playing games 2, 3, 4 hours a day in your 30s, bro, before I say I'm okay with you, your life better be way better than mine. If it's not, you could be building a better life instead of wasting it on freaking ones and zeros and digital fantasy. That includes doom scrolling. Includes, again, you could become addicted to TikTok. You could become addicted to anything. The question is the addiction healthily, can you healthily channel the addiction, or is it taking from you? This is the bigger problem. Okay, I go to work, I do my job, I don't hurt anybody, I don't rob, I don't steal, I'm physically in good shape. Like, why does it matter? Because is it taking from you? You should evaluate everything in your life from that lens. Does this give to me or does it take from me? And if it takes from you, you have to be really careful with it. And cannabis can be, I believe, a medication. It can be useful. It can be a giver. But it has tremendous potential to be a taker. I have seen people, and one in particular I'm thinking of is no longer using any substances. I have never seen somebody use cannabis to the level this guy did, and it was destroying his life from what I could see. And I had a hard time accept, because I occasionally use cannabis. And I can't even understand how a person could be fucking stoned from the minute they get up till they go to bed. And then start all over. But this guy did it. And it started to really destroy him as a person. And again, I want to just say one more time before we move on, that can be true of anything. Anything that has the potential for addiction can destroy a life. It can become a taker, even if it normally is a giver. Exercise can be a giver. I've also seen people destroy their bodies with excessive exercise. So that's my thoughts on it. Let's move on and talk about clinch collars, or prong collars, as Joe calls them. That's the right. I call them clinch. He calls them prong. He's right. I'm wrong, but that's what I'm going to call them. And introducing those to your dogs.
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you with another expert counsel segment. And I'm still referring to Chris's questions. He had sent me quite a few questions in his email, so I needed to break those up into some segments. So this will be part two. And specifically on this one, he was asking about the prong collar. So if you remember last time we talked, his dog ran off with his collars, came back with no collars. And he was asking, when should the prong collar stay on? When should I take it off? And so basically, there's two different kinds of prong collars. There's the ones that we sell that have a quick release on them. So you just push a button, they open up, and then you slide the buckle back together, it snaps in, and it's easy to put on and take off. And if you're using one of these collars, the big benefit to these is it's very easy to take it off and put it back on the dog. Now, in terms of how often the dog should wear the collars, I recommend that they pretty much live in their collars if your dog is living with you and with you all the time. Now, here's a couple of exceptions to that. If you keep them in a kennel of any kind, especially like a chain link kennel or a kennel with any kind of wire edges to it, take the prong collar off because you don't want it to get hooked or caught. If you use the wire crates for your dog at night, take the prong collar off for the same reason so it doesn't get caught. Now, if you use the plastic crates that we like, the Very Kennel types of crates, then you almost never have a problem with that. I leave the prongs on the dogs at nighttime when they're in those kinds of crates. But if you are in a wire crate, I would take it off. Now, in general, what he actually asked was, do I only keep the prong on him when I'm actively working him? And here's the reality of training your dog. You're always training them. So in my opinion, you're always actively working the dog. Now, what does that mean? If you're going to let your dog run on your property, then, and these collars are like $60 a piece, then probably take it off if you're going to let him run around the property. If you have multiple dogs and they like to play, take the prong collars off, because the only times I've lost these collars are when the dogs are playing and they'll kind of mouth at each other's collars and their teeth can press the button and it'll fall off, and then either you find it with the lawnmower or you don't find it at all. And so that would be another time that you might want to take the prong collar off. But here's what I do with our dogs. When my dogs are with me, they're always working. In order to have freedom, to have free range and run around, they have to earn that freedom. And they earn their freedom by being obedient. That means if I call you, you stop whatever you're doing and you come right to me. And if you don't stop what you're doing and come to me, then I'm going to put the prong and the lead back on you, and you're not going to have that freedom for a little bit, and then we'll give it a try again later. But when I have my dogs with me, I always want them with me, and I always want them under obedience. Now, obedience can be your free run around. But then when I say, okay, let's go, I've ceased to give you the freedom and I'm calling you back to me now, right? And if you don't get this kind of obedience in your dog before you start letting them free range and run all over the place, you're going to have a really hard time getting consistent obedience in your dog, because your dog's like, well, most of the time I get to run around and do whatever I want, so why do I have to listen to you right now? So it might seem a little bit cruel, because when you first start, the dog's going to be like, oh man, I really want to go over there and run around and do stuff that I want to do. And they'll kind of look a little depressed and a little upset. But again, remember, we're training discipline into our dogs. And discipline is not doing an obedience command when I tell you. Discipline is doing the obedience command when I tell you, even when you don't want to. Right? So discipline is doing a thing even when you don't want to. And we really need that in our dogs, because sometimes they're going to really want to do something, and that thing is either destructive to something on our property, it could hurt them, or it could hurt another person, or they could end up running out into a road or something like that, right? So when I give a dog a command, it's a command, not a suggestion. And the best way to get that with your dogs is to have them with you on a lead all the time. And if you need a break, either put them in the crate or put them on a tie-out, okay, or a kennel, works just fine too. But that way they have a space where they're confined, they can kind of do what they want to, but they're not going to go cause problems with things. And then I don't leave them there very long, and then I get them, and when they're with me, they're doing obedience, right? Either they're learning to walk with me, they're learning a sit or a lay down, they're learning a wait. And so that in the house, I can take them into the house, I can put them in a position, and I can walk away and they'll stay there, right? And they're not going to do that right off the bat, so you're going to have to train them to do that. But even when I'm doing other things, Like, I film this video, and then I sit down and I do a quick edit, and then I save it as an MP3 file and send it to Jack, and I save it as a video and I upload it to YouTube. He's learning to lay here while I do that. I film a video, I stop, I do some other things, and I come back, and he's still learning to lay here. So even as I'm doing other things, my dogs are still in training. Right now, you have to make a couple of moderations probably to your daily life. We've done this so long that this is our daily life. But like, if I'm sitting and working on a laptop and I have a charging cable, I'm not going to have a young puppy at my feet and not check on them frequently to make sure they don't chew my $80 or $90 charging cable in half, right? And so there's a few little things you might have to do to modify your lifestyle. And then if you need a break, set up a tether where they have shade, shelter, food, and water. Have a kennel or a crate and start kennel training them or crate training them. And all those things are going to be useful down the road, and they give you a break while you're training. And so that was the big one, is when do we use the prong collar? If you want more details on how to use the prong collar, we have that in Canine Academy. You can go to Jack's website, thesurvivalpodcast.com. Click on the banner and sign up for Canine Academy, and we show you how to size it, how to use it, and all that kind of stuff. But in terms of when to keep the prong or whatever correction collar you have on versus off, that's my recommendations. All right, so I hope that's been helpful for you. We already talked about Canine Academy, but go over to Jack's website if you want more details on training your dog. If you are looking to buy a fully trained dog or a working line puppy, we breed Malinois, Dutch Shepherds, and German Shepherds. We almost never do this, but we have a 20% off sale right now. That's $500 off on a puppy purchase. That goes for our basic puppies and our advanced puppies. And if you're interested in that, go visit fortresscanine.com. You can click on our puppy page. You can click on the consult form and send me a consultation that comes into my emails. And I will reach out to you, and we will get you all the details and get you set up if that's something that you're looking to do. So remember, until next time, train hard and stay safe.
Fully agree. Just reiterate the concerns about the collar snagging, because the dog can totally freak out. And there's things that can snag on that you wouldn't think of. My wife has these two big, like fluffy pillows, like couch pillows, like super long ones that have like stringy, like yarn is the surface. And when we first got Belle, she got hung up in it. She kind of freaked her out. We were right there, so be careful with that. Now, on the pretty much live in them, up until the point where the discipline's instilled, I agree. And we went beyond that. Like, when Belle was in her Maligator stage, where they're kind of, you know, maturing, she basically drug a leash inside the house for a year until she got into the mode of understanding. Like, because then when she started acting up, you stub on a leash, self-correction, right? She's such a great dog now. She barely wears a damn thing. Unless we're going out in public, or we're taking her somewhere where, like, we really don't want her to be able to slip a collar if something comes up or something like that. She pretty much runs around clinch collar free, but this is a different, like, we made a homestead dog, not a protection dog. So that might change your mileage variation as well. Next up, let's hear from Andy McCann on alternative forms of medicine.
Hello and good morning, TSP community. This is Andy McCann here from CrossFit Garage in Woodstock, Georgia. My job is to help you look good naked and become hard to kill. Okay, in that, we were just at the fall workshop. I'm not sure when this episode will come out, but we were just there. Lots of questions about, Andy, what are the crazy things that you do for health and fitness that are not the normal thing? So we talked a lot about that, and I thought, okay, I'm going to share it on an episode with you guys so you can go down your own rabbit hole. The short story is, yes, it is true. My family is very granola when it comes to medicine. We don't have a primary doctor. I don't have a primary doctor. We don't really have a pediatrician. We got fired from the pediatrician because we weren't getting the kids shots. Most of my kids have no shots whatsoever. I didn't know, a tetanus shot? What is that? That's a vaccine as well. I didn't know what was what. Anyway, we got fired from the original pediatrician because I asked a question, so we don't normally go to the doctor, but my wife has gone down the road of how to heal us without hurting us. One of the things is we use those essential oils. So she does doTERRA, and I don't know, there's a couple brands. I don't know if the brand matters. I'm not that deep into it. She makes a thing called Mugganasty. I'll get the recipe and put it, I'll send it over to Jack. But essentially, you put a couple drops of like oregano and breathe and peppermint and something else. And then you put in a mug or in a bottle or whatever. And then you put boiling water into it and let it steam, and you breathe it in. And it has really helped us out. Back when things were really messy back in 2020, when they went to shut down the world for 2 weeks, we used that and we were pretty good. All right, so there is that. I'll give you that. Mug and nasty. The next thing is we do enemas. So there's a lady, Dr. Denmark. If you go look up Dr. Denmark, 104-year-old pediatrician, and I think it was like Suwanee, Georgia. She's dead now, but I think the book is called What Did Dr. Denmark Say? She was big on those. So one of my in-laws, when one of the kids was really, really sick, she said, hey, to bring down the temperature, you can try a baby enema. I thought, what is that craziness? Go look it up. But essentially, your backside has all the stuff that is trying to excrete. If you put water up there, it gets it out faster. I know, super weird, but we've used that a lot and avoided many sicknesses, so I think. And also, when the kids are like, hey, I'm not going to go to school, you're like, okay, great. So I guess if you're that sick, they're like, no, I'm going to school. So maybe it fixed them like that, too. The other weird thing I did was this Ebu. Let's see if I can find it. There's some, I'm looking at video prompts or web page prompts when I talk to you guys. So EBU is external blood oxygenation and ozonation. So basically they take your blood out, they filter it, they blow ozone over it, they oxygenate it, they hit it with UV lights, and then they put it back in. That's supposedly doing the things that your body does, except giving it a boost because maybe you're under some sort of stress with a disease, parasites, or whatever. So does it help? I don't know. I just did it right before the fall workshop, and what it did for me was knock me out. So I did get so they have a 2-liter bottle where they capture the stuff, the waste product, if you will. And in that 2-liter bottle, there was about a soda can's worth of what to me looked like somebody that was super hydrated and was peeing into a bottle. So it's mostly clear with a little bit of yellow and foam on top. That's inflammation and other stuff that the machine was able to capture and pull out. What exactly is it? I don't know. I didn't pay the money to go find out. I just know that it came out. Okay, so another thing that we're doing, I mentioned this to a couple of you guys, we actually have our nutrition kickoff coming up. So if you want to do our nutrition, it is not carnivore. It is a habits-based nutrition. Coach Jennifer is going to be running this. It starts January 3rd. Just let me know. I'll hook you up with the email address and all that. Andy@CrossFitGarage.com. So that's coming. We typically do that just to, and I still do this, just to reaffirm what I already know or to pick up a piece that I didn't know before. All right, the last thing was these LifeWave patches that my wife is into. It's called X39. You'll have to talk to her about what it exactly does. Here's what I know. Anecdotally, so N equals 1, is it just a one-person thing or is it for realsy? You'll have to find that out for yourself. It is a technology that a guy made for the military, then he took it to the public and then said, hey, our sales to doctor's offices aren't great. Let's open it up to like a Mary Kay or Amway style and let people who have testimonies share and sell. So anyway, this is what my wife is doing. She started patching me and basically when I'd go to sleep, she'd slap one on my neck and my completely white hair has been slowly adding black to it. Is it placebo? Maybe, but I don't know. It's non-chemical. It is a reflective technology. In a nutshell, everything is a spectrum of light. So if you have a thermoscope, you can see the heat off your body. Heat can be light if you can see it like the movie Predator. So what it does is it uses crystal structures like salts and sugars or whatever to reflect that light wave or that, I don't know, Roy G. Biv, right? That wave, that heat wave back into you. And I think what it does is gives it some sort of feedback loop and it says, hey, that's not going well. Let me fix it. So for me, it's been my hair's been turning black. Other people have had other things. Is it for you? I don't know. You're going to have to talk to my wife about that. I will also put her link over to Jack so that you guys could ask her some questions. Her name is Verity. She is awesome with this. She's been helping our family, I guess since 2002 when we had our first kid. So guys, it doesn't have to be hard. It doesn't have to be complicated. I would first start with the big three, how you eat, sleep, and move, and then start adjusting little by little on the other stuff. Give things a try, see if they work. Maybe they're not for you. Maybe they are. You don't know until you try. If you need help, I'm here for you, Andy@CrossFitGarage.com. If you happen to be in Woodstock, come to the gym. Or if you're passing through Woodstock, we've got a tiny little farm with a garage, room over the garage. You can stay with us. Well, those that we know, right, from the fall workshop. If you're just a total random, that might be kind of weird. All right, guys. Hey, if you need help, I am here for you. My job is to help you look good naked and become harder to kill. Take care, guys.
Some interesting alternatives there from Andy. Let's go on and talk about bolt-action rifles with Mike Melito as big game season is here and or coming, depending on where you are.
Hey guys, Michael here from Gunfighter Life Podcast to answer your gun content for the Expert Council. It is or is about to be hunting season for big game in most of the country. God bless me to punch my elk tag last week. For many of you, rifle season is just gearing up. The majority of you, if you're hunting with a rifle, are going to be hunting with a bolt-action rifle. Not all bolt-action rifles are created equal. All kinds of variances and nuances in bolt-action rifles. But they fall into some broad categories. I'm going to try to, in a 7-ish minute segment, break some of those down fairly easily. Push feed versus controlled round feed. Controlled round feed means that when the round is getting taken out of the magazine, the extractor, usually a big giant claw, will grab that round and guide it into the chamber and then pull it out of the chamber. Through almost that entire process, that extractor has positive control on that round. So if you move the bolt front or back, that cartridge is controlled by the bolt, controlled round feed. With a push feed, that round is going to pop up out of the magazine and kind of be free-floating. Then you're going to shove that bolt forward, and that round is just going to be shoved in front of the bolt, but not attached to the bolt until you slam that bolt closed and that extractor gets shoved over the rim of the cartridge. That is a push feed. You're pushing it into the chamber. Now, the main advantage of controlled round feed is it eliminates a lot of potential problems you can get. Much harder to get a double feed where two rounds are trying to fight for the chamber with a controlled round feed rifle. Also, if that rifle is not oriented up and down, you're less likely to have an issue where the round comes out of the chamber. Also, almost all the time, the controlled round feed is going to have a big, beefy steel extractor that takes up a significant portion of the case, which means you're less likely to get a round stuck in the chamber because you have much more to grab onto with that controlled round feed. The classic controlled round feed is going to be the Mauser and pretty much anything based on the Mauser design. Mauser 98, the 1903 Springfield, your Winchester Model 70s, your Kimber 84s. But the vast, vast majority of the market is going to be a push feed. A big reason, if I'm being honest, is because they're cheaper. Kind of like polymer striker-fired handguns. It doesn't mean they're better, they're just cheaper to make. That's why they're the majority of the market, and they work okay. But to be fair, push feeds, because if you look at a picture of both bolts, they're quite a bit more simplistic and symmetrical. They tend to be more accurate for a given price point. Now, you can get a very accurate controlled round feed rifle, but in general, you're going to get a more accurate rifle on your push feed design for the same price. It's another reason they're so common today. And this is going to be the majority of stuff on the market today. Your Remington 700, your Savage designs, your Ruger Americans, your Tikas, all push feeds. Another thing is 2-lug versus 3-lug. There's some other stuff. There's like the Weatherby 9-lug. And some other things out there, rear locking lugs. But in general, most bolt-action rifles are going to fall into two main categories. The lugs on the front of the bolt that lock into the chamber are going to be 2-lug or 3-lug. And it's not exact, but you generally will say that a 2-lug bolt has a 90-degree bolt throw, and a 3-lug will have somewhere around a 60-degree bolt throw. So that you have to move the bolt less distance to open and close the bolt, as far as getting it locked and unlocked. You might think, well, why not just do less? Doesn't that sound better? Well, part of the operation of the bolt, almost all bolt actions are cock on open, except for the Enfields, and I don't know many people using those anymore. The majority are cock on open, which means you have to reset that firing mechanism. You have to recoil that spring, recock that spring, reset the firing pin, And that takes a certain amount of force for that gun to operate reliably. You have to put that amount of force on the bolt. So although you have to move a three lug less, you have to do the same amount of work in a shorter amount of distance, which means that it's going to be more abrupt when you have to apply that force. If you have a longer distance to do the same amount of work, it's going to be more gradual, and that's going to be your 90 degree. Also, again, this is broad generalization, but two lugs are simpler than three lugs. Another thing to consider is if you're going to put a large scope, which I'm generally not a fan of, but if you're going to put one of these big, giant scopes on the top of your rifle, sometimes it can interfere with bolt movement. Since your bolt has to be lifted up less on a three-lug bolt system, a 60-degree bolt throw, I think that's one of the reasons they've become more popular in recent years. People are going to these bigger and bigger scopes and longer-range stuff, which, again, I'm not a big fan of, but if that's your use case, you may get into a situation where you're going to have interference with that bolt and that scope. And a 60-degree bolt throw may alleviate some of that. Now, the reason I thought of this is I'm doing a whole mini-series on Gunfighter Life podcast where I get real, real nerdy into a lot of nuance of this stuff. Just calling it Bolt Gun University, if you want to check that out. But to keep it brief here, those are some of the main things. Just so you have an educated look at bolt actions, that way you, unless you just want the latest and greatest, you're not bamboozled into getting, you know, whatever's hot on Instagram that influencers are pushing because it's got a cool Cerakote job or in the next latest and greatest caliber that's 50 feet a second faster than one that's been around 100 years. Actually make an informed decision on what bolt action rifle is best for you. The good news is there are a ton of really good bolt action rifles on the market, and despite what marketing and hype would have you believe, the vast majority of them will get your hunting taken care of. You don't go ridiculous in the caliber or something. Whether you're hunting with a bolt action or a lever action 30-30, hopefully you're getting out there. Get out there, enjoy the beauty of creation, see a sunrise, a sunset in a wild place, and provide some meat for you and your family. Thanks, TSP. Thanks, Jack, and have a blessed day.
I don't really have anything to add to that discussion on the different types of bolt actions. That really wasn't anything to do with brand. This time of year, especially here in Texas, we start to have like the big gun shows. And I always like to point out to people that are in the market for, you know, a good bolt action hunting rifle, even brand new, but certainly when you start looking at guns that are 20, 30 years old that are in the used market, one of the best values in just good old fashioned bolt action hunting rifles, they're ugly, they're inexpensive, and they're accurate AF, right? The Savage Model 110 and the Model 10. Right, like your short and long action Savage rifles. And, you know, they've made some improvements of them. They've introduced the AccuTrigger, I guess, about 20-plus years ago now, and that's great and all. But even your just old-school, original Savage 110s and 10s, you know, I have a 308 Savage, and it's an that gun's, I had to get it 20 years ago, and it was 15, 20 years old when I got it. And I got it for a song. And I've killed so many deer with that gun. The Savage 110... Savage, they're just one of the most accurate, out-of-the-box rifles that you can find. One of the negatives for them, if you're buying a new rifle compared to like a really nice Remington or a Winchester or, you know, really upscale like a Weatherby, maybe a Browning somewhere in between, they do not tend to hold their value across time the way these prettier, you know, prettier baby guns do, right? And because of that, they are not necessarily the best thing to invest in brand new, though I do think they're a very good deal as a brand new tool. But when you're at the gun shows, when you're looking for used guns, when you're on GunBroker, these older guns are so inexpensive, it doesn't even really make any sense versus the quality they have. And I think the quality has been undervalued, especially by newer, younger people that don't remember when Savage was like the common man's rifle that you bought. When you, that was your first bolt action, you didn't have a lot of money, and you could buy it. Now, how good a deal am I talking? Like, without even looking hard, while he was talking, I pulled up GunBroker, looked for Savage 110s, found a 3006 Savage 110, current bid on it, $153. Bid's only like 48 hours from closing out. The buy it now price, $325. with a decent 3x9 bushnell on it. But let's say you throw away the bushnell. These were quality, it was a quality set of Weaver mount and rings. So that's $50 to $70 in the rings and the mounts. And so even if the scope is dog shit, and sometimes when you buy a used gun with a scope on it, here's what I always say. Unless you know who owned it, assume the scope is dog shit. It's not holding zero anymore, whatever at all. But rings, you know, you look at a brand, you can count on them, right? Maybe the one scope I would put an exception to that is like Leupold. If you bust a Leupold, you did something really bad. But just throw out the value of the scope. $325 for a 3006, that perfect working order, not the prettiest stock, big old ugly nut on the barrel, which is actually cool because you can swap barrels on a Savage and reset headspace really, really easy if you want to get into that. Plus rings and mounts for $325 in a 3006 without even trying to look for a deal. I've picked up some of like Savage 308, Savage 708, like some really cool rifles at gun shows for right in the $200 range. And some of them, like the one I found on GunBroker, a little bit, you can tell it's been used, right? This is not a cabinet queen. This gun has been in the field, probably shot a lot of deer, drawn a lot of blood, been scraped up a little bit. I found some that look like they were never fired in the $200 to $250 range. You're talking high point ghetto Glock pistol prices on a gun that you could probably hunt your whole life with and leave to your grandkids. So when you're in the market for a bolt, and unless you have I'm going to build a 6.5 Creed, I'm going to do it on this platform. Okay, that's great. I do that shit too. I get it. You just want a gun to go hunt with, or you're buying one for like a nephew or a kid. As long as you get the caliber, it's appropriate for the recoil they can handle. You're a new hunter. You don't know if you're going to keep with this. You don't want to go out and spend a couple $1,000 on a setup. Please look at these older Savages because, my God, the value they represent is ridiculous. They are underappreciated, and maybe we'll do a show on Savage rifles in the future, especially older set pre-AccuTrigger Savage rifles and some of the cool things you can do with them with gunsmithing projects and stuff like that as well. All right, let's hear before you get my segment today on tree nuts from Kerry Brown. We'll see what he says about black walnut because that's one of his main things he's going to talk about here. And does he know what I know about the black walnut and what we used to use it for?
Hey, TSP community. Kerry here with Strong Roots Resources. And we're in early November now. We're actually having first snow of the year, which is a little crazy if you ask me. But I want to talk to you a little bit about foraging some tree nuts. A couple of common ones that are fairly easy to maybe not technically harvest, but it can be done. But very common that also have some medicinal qualities as well. So let's talk about the black walnut. Several things I'd like to mention about the black walnut. First of all, as a landscape tree, they're pretty common in neighborhoods. It seems like people always plant them next to sidewalks and driveways, and that is perhaps not the best choice. In our case here, they're out in the pasture, so they don't really cause us any issues. I will tell you that if you are running a commercial lawnmower and the guard is down, those mowers will launch a walnut. So take that into consideration if you want to plant one of these trees somewhere. I would keep it on an edge that is not needing a bunch of interaction with a lawnmower. But these are actually highly valuable trees. The lumber is really prized, and it always has a beautiful grain, and they really do tend to grow straight with pretty wide spacing on the limbs. So they're very common as board wood. You can get nice clean planks without a whole lot of knots and irregularities. Here on the farm, we have several black walnuts that I don't think any of us technically planted them. I think the squirrels just planted them, and they're all having a really heavy mast year. In fact, a lot of the nut trees we have around here are dropping way more nuts than they normally do. And sometimes trees will just do that. They'll just go through a cycle where they produce a lot, whether that's because that tree feels the need to give itself greater chances of propagation to provide more food sources for the wildlife, because perhaps winter's going to be a rough one. We're not real sure why that is, but I think it's very interesting that they do. So the black walnut, when you find it on the ground, is a rock-hard tennis ball-looking thing with a bright green husk. And this husk will eventually just turn black and disintegrate off. And that'll actually leave you with the outer shell of the nut, but you have some work to do to get to the actual nut meat. That husk, however, that dark black kind of dye, and it can be used as a dye. Walnut dye is a thing, but that husk contains anti-parasitical properties, and so it's very common to find various types of tinctures and even black walnut teas that can help address parasite problems in humans, in livestock, even in your pets. If you want to collect these, I found the best way to do it is just wherever you put them, just get them out of the weather and don't pile them too deep. One time I put a whole bunch in a garbage can, and that was a bad idea. So maybe just two or three layers deep, and that will give them a chance to dry out without having a bunch of mold issues and that kind of thing kick off. So we're looking at, I would say the actual nut, once the husk is gone, it's relatively large compared to other tree nuts. Even, 1.5 to 2.5 inches, depending. And it can be a good bit of work to actually shell that nut. So, and get down to the nut meat. There are a number of devices available now, nutcracker type devices that will save you a lot of work. My old school way of doing it involved a hammer and some channel locks and some safety glasses, and it took a long time. But black walnut meat is very high in protein. It's high in fat. Tree nuts are one of nature's very few ways, I should say, non-animal ways of providing fat in the diet, which is the hardest thing to come by in nature, assuming that you are not hunting or trapping. I think they have this really bold and earthy flavor, and certain black walnuts are real common in a lot of your baked dishes and such, especially here when we're getting into the holidays. All kinds of confections and whatnot contain that. So keep that in mind for your kind of real obvious nuts to be harvested for the black walnut. I just think it's I think because you see this tree in places where it's kind of a nuisance, it gets a bad rap. So that's definitely like a right plant, right place kind of thing. The other one I want to talk to you about today are hickory nuts. And there's many, many varieties of hickories out there. But here around our region, shagbark, mockernut, pignut hickory, those are the most common ones. And those are the ones where the husk will split into four sections. And so it's very common if you're under a hickory tree to see just the little wedge-shaped sections of nut. Of husk, because usually the squirrels or a number of other critters out there have made off with the nuts themselves. The nuts are oval to round, and they have thick shells, and the nut meats are, a lot of times to me, they taste sweet, and they're also a little bit oilier, so again, another source of fat that nature provides. I think they're really tasty, and they're kind of hard to come by in stores. So if you have a really good producing hickory tree, that's a prize. Again, there's various kinds of nutcrackers. I haven't tried any of these commercial ones, but I'm pretty sure I have a well-reviewed product for cracking nuts bookmarked, and I will dig that out and make sure I send that along to Jack so that you guys could save yourself the hassle, because this is kind of what the bummer is about harvesting tree nuts, is that it's it's very labor intensive. So we'll see what tools are out there. While I'm also talking about the hickory tree, you can make hickory syrup from the bark of the shagbark hickory. And Andy Eddings made some one time and shared it with me, and it was amazing. It was amazing. So hit up Andy and maybe talk to him about that sometime, how he made that. And then lastly, I want to talk a little bit about the American beech tree. Beech nuts get, I think, overlooked quite a bit. So you're going to find these in more mature forests, and they really like to be around other trees. It's kind of rare to just see a beech tree out by itself. You don't usually find them as specimen plantings in neighborhoods and such. So you need to get out into the woods to find these in most cases. I almost always find them around oaks and maples. They all seem to want to share the same kind of habitat and soil structure. So these are the ones that have a very smooth, grayish bark. It doesn't have a lot of furrowing or rippling or any other features to it in terms of the texture, but it will have a kind of some greenish to grayish blotchiness in the actual coloring of the bark. Their nuts are a little unusual looking. They're triangular, and they're enclosed in spiny burrs, and they open to release small three-sided nuts. And these nuts are a lot smaller, but they're really tasty. I think they're a lot like almonds. That's what they remind me of. You do need to peel off a thin brown skin before you eat them, but they are good raw, roasted, or if you grind them into a kind of a nut meal. And beech nuts they tend to have a mast year and then take 2 or 3 years off. So if you find some beech trees and you're not finding nuts, they might just be taking a year off from heavy production. So I wanted to put that in your all's ears to consider when you're exploring your neighborhoods or your local forests and parks. These days, a lot of people don't really bother to pick up tree nuts, and a lot of times they just get discarded right along with leaf pickup and that sort of thing. So get out there and look around and interact with them a little bit. I think they're worth having around. And, you know, nut trees can certainly serve as the overstory into a food forest if that's something that you're working on making. So Give them a try and let me know. That's what I got for you guys today. Reach out to me, strongrootsresources.com, if I can help you with any of your homestead design, food forest design, or anything along those lines, from the urban on up to the small scale farm. I'd be happy to have a conversation with you about that, and we'll talk to you guys next time.
So an interesting thing here to me anyway is all of these nuts, hickory nuts, beech nuts, black walnuts, and then I'll add to that pecans and English walnuts, Carpathian walnut. All of these nuts are part of the jiggling family, and they all have that same thing in common where they are an allopathic species, where things like their holes, the nuts, the nut holes, and the kind of that jacket, that husk, the husk, the hole, the nut, the leaves, etc., all actually interfere with the growth patterns of other species. That's an anti-competitive thing, and that's why you'll find these huge stands of black walnuts without much else growing in the wild in many ways. That's just an interesting thing to me. Now, he mentioned cracking them. They are hard to crack. I have found one, without going full-scale commercial, one tool that actually does what it says it does when it comes to black walnuts. And it's the brand is called Grandpa's Goody Getter. This thing has a massive mechanical advantage. It's not cheap. It's $200. If you want to open like 20 of them, get a hammer and go to work, right? If you have a lot of black walnuts and you really want to make use of the food source, this thing is, from what I can see with it and having used it a couple times, you could use this thing for a lifetime and it's going to keep working. And I opened a lot of black walnuts as a kid because we had a lot of them on the property, and my grandpa had this really heavy-duty old piece of oak with a hole in it, and you put the thing in, you hit it on the tip, and it splits on it, and it works sometimes. This thing works all the time. It's a really great tool. It's $200. So it's not for everybody. It is available on Amazon, and I did put a link to it under Carrie's segment in case you're interested in it. Because if you have, and I will tell you that black walnut does a lot of things really well. They're just delicious in itself. It's good in baked goods. My grandmother used to make a nut roll out of it that was fantastic, and I was willing to beat those things just to get them out of it. I wish I would have had Grandpa's goodie getter back then. It does a lot of things really, really well. It makes excellent bitters for cocktails. It has this really unique, almost like a bite flavor to it that is different than a standard walnut, and it also makes pretty amazing pickled thing that I won't get into today. So there's a lot you can do with it. And he mentioned using it as a dye, but he didn't mention using it as a dye the way that we did. When those husks turn that blue-black color, they were traditionally used by rifle makers and flintlock makers and musket makers in colonial America to brown steel, not blue as we think of today, brown steel. And we used it for the same thing for our traps, our leg hold traps, coil springs, our long springs, our conibear traps. Every year, we would reseason the traps. We'd clean them all up. We'd get a 50-gallon drum, put it up on some cinder blocks, and build a fire underneath it and build a big boiling cauldron. And we would get tons and tons of the husks that he's talking about from the black walnuts and throw them in there. And then we would dip our traps, pull them out after they were in there for a while, let them dry, and rub them down with like a beeswax to keep them seasoned so they wouldn't rust while out in field sets every year. And this is an unknown use by a lot of people. This is, you know, old school Appalachia would know this. And if you do it, it's how much, I don't know, until the old man went, that's enough, right? That was it, right? Like, and it really is, just throw it in there, it'll work. But wear gloves, or you will have purplish blue black hands for a week. Ask me how I know. All right, because it's always fun to let the kid do it. Like, oh, Grandpa, look at it. Yeah. Okay, look at your hands, kid. Go wash them off. And you're like, it doesn't come off. Yeah, it'll come off later. Little hazing never went, you know, it was never too much of a bad thing. Anyway, with that, let's move on to my segment, though. Let's talk about, you know, maybe you should start your New Year's resolution now, like this week, like Friday, like today, like tomorrow, like Saturday, like Monday. I don't know, whenever you want to do it. And I want to talk about a couple things with that. This is what is, this has been a pattern in my life at times. It isn't anymore, but it has been. I'm going to do a New Year's resolution. You figure that out about right now. That's what I'm saying, just go ahead and do it. This is about the time people start thinking about it. And what they think is, well, you know, Thanksgiving's going to come. I'm going to eat pumpkin pie, have a bunch of wine, watch a football game, lay on my ass, you know, have family over, or I'm going to travel. It's just not a good time. And then Christmas is going to come. So New Year's is perfect. Like, when you hit New Year's, like, if you've ever looked, like, there's not a lot going on all the way out to, like, Easter. President's Day is not a big you might do a little shopping, but it's not. You're not going to eat President's Day cake, right? So, like, there's this big, long path after New Year's. So it's a new year. Plus, you have this, like, lack of disruption. And it's winter, and you spend more time inside. And so it's just a good time, except that it's not. Because it does two things. One, it puts you in the herd because everybody's doing it. And when everybody's in the herd, when the herd falls, you follow the herd. So it has like a kind of a built-in self-destruct mechanism. Okay. But the other thing it does is it gives you a license to abuse yourself over the next 6 to 9 weeks. Well, screw it. Right? Like, might as well drink on Tuesday, you know, when I'm getting ready for Thanksgiving, because screw it. Right, might as well drink all weekend. You get into holiday parties, man, screw it. You know, like, and whatever it is that you're changing about your behavior, it becomes a big screw it for like 2 months. So you now are in you're in a worse physical, mental, emotional state after the holidays when you're starting your program. And this is what, like, a lot of guys that go in the military. I remember even back, you know, 30-odd years ago now, almost 40 years. Wow, that makes me feel old. Guys came to the military out of shape. So basic was just misery on them. Absolute misery. Very few people, and I was at least smart enough to, because I wasn't a genius my whole life, I promise you. I did some dumb shit. But one thing I did do, the day I took my oath of enlistment and I had to like finish high school and get out of school and then go to the military, I decided right then, you know, I was an athlete and all, but I was in even better shape. I started weight training. I started running. I started doing the three primary exercises for the physical fitness test, which is 2 mile run, push-ups, and sit-ups. And I went to basic in shape. Okay? So I'm going to tell you that even if you're going to do like the kind of New Year's thing, you're going to really ramp it up, say January 2, start now. Go into that resolution in emotional and physical shape. But Jack, on Thanksgiving, my whole family's going to come over and eat the fucking pumpkin pie. Eat the mashed potatoes. Here's another advantage. Start to get yourself in better shape. When you eat that food, you'll feel like dog shit. It won't be a denial thing then. And when you eat the forgotten cookies around Christmas and you eat too much sugar, you're not going to feel that great in the after effect. Right? Instead of going on a bender for 2 months, start putting some discipline in your life. And Joel said that discipline is doing what you need to do even when you don't want to do it. Another way of looking at discipline, and Andy said, I totally wrote this into my new book already, right? Andy said at the workshop, Andy McCann, that discipline is a hard today for an easy tomorrow, which I think is a really interesting way to look at things. So go ahead and enjoy the holiday. Because here's the thing, like when you start that thing, even if you make it, if you're one of the people that doesn't follow the herd back into retreat, and you know, by June, you're a whole new man or woman, you've got your business on track, you got your mind on track, you got your body on track, you got your diet on track, you're still going to have holidays. Because you have birthdays and stuff like that. And I've always said, like, unless you're the person like with the huge family and the kids have friends that have kids that have friends that have, where you're like at a birthday 3 times a week, eat the birthday cake, eat the hot dog on 4th of July, eat the turkey on Thanksgiving, eat the freaking pumpkin pie. Do the things on those days, not for an entire 2 months. Under the auspice of, but when it's over, then I'm going to. But are you? But are you? Or are you going to go into that with all these big emotional plans when you just blew discipline to dog shit for 60 days or more? And you are at a low point in your physical and emotional health because of that, while we're dealing with the short days, the long nights, the cold weather, all of the depression that can come along with that, and now you're going to take on dragons and slay them and take over the world? Or can you right now take the time and kind of ease into it? Come up with the new daily routine. Come up with the new emotional routine. You're going to start journaling now. You don't have to wait till January 2nd. You're going to start working out now. You don't have to go into killer workouts where you feel like your arms are going to fall off. Get up every morning really early and take a walk. If you're going to get on a new program, do that. If you're going to start building your business, do that. If you're going to start formulating a new marketing plan for your business, if you're finally getting your side hustle, start now. And by the way, this advice applies all the time. There is no point in I'm going to change my life next week, next month, next year. If you're having that internal dialogue with yourself, right now, I need to make a change. I need to get healthier. I'm getting older and I need to start taking better care of myself as I age. I'm young and I'm 20 and I look great now, but I have bad habits and I'm looking at my contemporary, you know, people in my life that are 40 years old and they're fat and lazy and slothly and I don't want to become that. Start now. If you're listening to this, like because you listen to older shows and it's June in 2027, start now. Do you see what I'm saying? But especially this time of year, this is a great time to instill some discipline before all the temptation comes. And to say, on Thanksgiving, I'm going to. But that doesn't mean that the day after Thanksgiving or the Saturday after Thanksgiving, I'm going to open the refrigerator and put a pile of stuffing the size of my head on a plate, cover it with half a gallon of gravy, and say, but it's just Thanksgiving. No, Thanksgiving was Thursday. Or in my family, Thanksgiving will be Friday. That way we won't have conflict with the other family members. And have it for those days, and have it for those times, and have it for those parties. And then put the portion size back. That's the other thing you can do. Like, I'm going to eat freaking mashed potatoes, gravy, stuffing, corn, turkey, and some form of bread on Thanksgiving Day. I am probably going to feel like dog crap after that, but I'm going to enjoy it. But I'm going to take my portion size down. Here's another hint for your holidays. Nobody ever gets on your ass when you put small portions on your plate. You eat your plate, you finish your plate, and you don't go back for seconds. People start strong like, bro, why aren't you eating any potatoes or stuffing, man? It's Thanksgiving. A couple tablespoons, and they leave you alone. When you finish eating, and you haven't eaten food like that much in your life, you enjoy it. That's a good thing. You enjoy it so much, you eat it faster than you should. That's not so good a thing. Because you eat it faster than you should, what happens is, oh, I'm going to do that again. This is my day. Wait 10 minutes when you're out of food before you go back for seconds. And you will find one of two things happen. You'll be like, nope, don't eat it. Or when you go back, it will truly be a small amount. Like you go back through and grab like two pieces of turkey and eat the turkey dipped in some gravy. You might even put it on your plate, right? Go have a nice, slow sipping wine or whiskey after the meal. Sit down in the soft chair. Talk to your family. Don't go extravagant, but enjoy the things. Because if this is why this is such a great time to do it. No matter how well you manage your life when it comes to diet, exercise, mental discipline, doing the things you need to do for your business, your life, to advance your career, whatever it is, there's always going to be disruptions. So starting in the middle of the disruptive period helps you set the pattern so that when you get to January 2, when the New Year's party is over, when the Christmas parties are over, when Christmas Day and Christmas dinner is over, when Thanksgiving is over, when the holidays have passed, and you've gone through that with a reasonable amount of discipline, you have an empty runway in front of you till Easter. Well, now instead of starting, you start pushing that throttle speed up. Think of it like not putting the gas pedal down in the car. Think about like if you've ever driven a boat with that hand throttle. That's where we're cruising along. We're, you know, we're sitting there. We're running about 14, 15 miles an hour on calm waters. There's a little bit choppy, so we don't want to push the boat too much. That's Christmas and Easter. Some chop and some wake. And all of a sudden, the glass water appears in front of you. And what do? Boom. 38 miles an hour. Bam! And 38 miles an hour in a small boat feels like you're whooping ass at about 90. That's what's in store for you if you start today. So, with that, let's go ahead and wrap up. But thank you guys for tuning in today. Again, enjoy those holidays, but don't procrastinate on changing your life. You can start changing your life this minute, right now, if you are having the conversation with yourself about there is something I want to do better, then you need to do it, or you wouldn't be having the conversation with yourself. Anyway, I enjoyed it. This has been a kind of a short week because I took Monday off, coming off of a workshop. I'm in my own recovery. There's a whole new level of the concept of a marathon when you go through a TSP workshop with all of the friends that come here. And so I'm still recovering from that. I'm glad the week is over. I'm excited about the coming week. I'm excited about having Ken come on Wednesday to talk to you guys about making Thanksgiving awesome, because we really can. We're going to have a good time going into the holiday season together. And with that, I'll catch you guys next week with another episode. They're gonna bail you out, just run you around. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Revolution.